Here's Eric listening in Chicago. Hi, Eric. What's up?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I really encourage people to give to Issues, et cetera, as it's the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the world, I'd say, on the media.
Issues, etc. is listener-supported, and you can support the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the media by making a secure online donation at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
You might have seen the story on Fox News or The Blaze or elsewhere. The story is a little boy brings candy canes with a Christian message on them, and then, at least according to the Daily Caller, the teacher snatched the candy from the child's hands, ripped the religious messages from each candy cane, and Fox News comments it takes a special kind of evil to confiscate a six-year-old child's Christmas gifts. Is that story true, and why do Christians react so strongly and believe what they read in these kinds of stories, often uncritically? Dr. Corey Moss joins us to talk about the story. He's assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, and author of a recent column for First Things titled A Teacher Slandered. Corey, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Why is it that Christians, many Christians, simply accept this scenario when it's presented in the press, and it often is teacher oppresses or embarrasses or harasses little kid in front of the class because of their faith? That's kind of the scenario that is often presented. Christians accept it and perpetuate it. Why do you think this is?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the sort of culture in which we live. I made reference in the article towards the end to this thing we often call the culture wars. And there really is a sort of us versus them mentality. And so when there's some question of faith in the public square, and especially if it's a denial of some sort of expression of faith in the public square, the immediate assumption is, well, this is us being persecuted by them, and we just know that they are liberals or agnostics or skeptics or atheists or something, and there's an automatic assumption that they are wrong if we have this sort of cultural war mentality. There's good guys and bad guys. And, I mean, on the one hand, that's perfectly understandable. That's human nature. But there are, of course, problems with our human nature.
As to the particular story that you wrote about in First Things, you do have, while not inside knowledge what was occurring in the classroom, you do know one of the people involved in it rather well, pastorally. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. It's a long time now. A family friend, a convert to Lutheranism, an adult convert to Lutheranism. Her husband and I were colleagues on the faculty at Concordia University in Irvine. So I've known them for some time. I know about their faith, how they came into the Lutheran faith, their practice of the faith and commitment to it. So I was, you know, needless to say, a little bit, you know, surprised when, you know, the implication in some of the media, and especially, I suppose, in the response to the media, you know, implied at least that this was some sort of religious bullying or religious intimidation motivated by a lack of religion or a hostility to religion.
So what was presented, and especially how it was interpreted, was that this teacher was somehow, for some reason, hostile to any kind of religious sentiments, and then the facts of the story were shaped based upon that assumption. Do you doubt the facts of the story as they're presented?
Well, I guess it depends upon who's presenting them in any particular case. And this is, I suppose, one of the problems with the way that the story is spread in the media. I mean, the facts as we initially have them are laid out in a demand letter presented by Robert Tyler of Advocates for Faith and Freedom, and what they do is attempt to protect religious liberty, which is of course an admirable goal. All of the facts that we have in that document, that demand letter, are of course secondhand, based upon the testimony of the student involved and the testimony related by him to relatives, and then on to Robert Tyler. And that demand letter is for the most part a relatively dispassionate recording of events, as the author understood them.
What are those events, briefly?
Well, the way it's presented is Isaiah Martinez is the first grade student who, before Christmas break, brought to school a box of candy canes, and on the candy canes was this legend of the origins and meaning of the candy cane and the symbolism of the shape and the color, testifying to the life and death of Jesus. There was to be a sort of pre-holiday party in which students could exchange gifts, and the question was raised whether he would be able to distribute gifts with an explicitly religious message on them. The teacher inquired with the principal. She held on to the candy canes while doing that. The principal eventually got back to her, as it turns out, not the same day, saying that, of course, the candy canes could be distributed, but not the religious message. The assumption, I suppose, being that this would be some sort of public school endorsement of the religious message. And so as the facts are laid out in this demand letter, the messages themselves were removed and placed back in the box. The candy canes were allowed to be distributed without the messages, and the messages were subsequently thrown away. The most provocative mention in here, than the one that Mays called the headlines, is the allegation that the teacher specifically told this student that the reason the messages had to be removed is because Jesus is not allowed at school. When that was taken up, and virtually all of the news stories dealing with this simply quote from or summarize that particular document, as far as I've been able to discern, no attempt has been made, at least none that's actually made it into the press, to talk to anyone else who was present in the classroom, to interview the teacher herself. But beyond that shortcoming, the story was sort of inflated, exaggerated, some purple prose and some inflammatory language was inserted. So, you know, not only did the teacher take possession of the candy while she was inquiring with her principal, but she quote-unquote snatched the candy from his hand. Phrases like religious bullying, religious intimidation were inserted into the news stories. And then purple prose such as, you know, right in front of this poor six-year-old set of eyes, she's throwing these messages in the trash. And, you know, without simply repeating hearsay from my side, of course I wasn't there, it didn't happen quite like that, and quite so confrontationally and quite so dramatically.
What does this tell you? I mean, you have seen the document where the complaint is first leveled, and then you have seen how that story grows, changes in the press accounts, and then how it also is further interpreted and let's just say, spun by Christians responding to it.
Sure.
What does it tell you, Dr. Moss?
Well, the first thing it tells me, which I guess it shouldn't need to be said, is that we all need to be a little bit skeptical about what we read in the media, especially when it's quite obvious that it's all secondhand and thirdhand. And I suppose, you know, those calling themselves Christians and conservatives especially, since there is this sometimes knee-jerk reaction to suspect that everything in the press is you know, has a liberal spin on it, we should be a little more wary when some news item comes along that seems to support our presuppositions. Further, and you know, the thing that really kind of prompted this, we should be careful how we respond to these stories. And conversely, I suppose that the press should be perhaps a little bit more responsible, because they're perfectly aware how readers and commenters are going to respond to the story based on how they've presented it. So, again, it hardly needs to be said, but when we read these stories, not only should we be skeptical, but we should hesitate to hop online and inflame the situation further by, you know, offering our own two cents about what we think we should happen to such people who do such things.
What set of presuppositions do you think have kind of been put into place among Christians that feed into this? That is, presuppositions about public schools, presuppositions about the people who teach there, about the rules that may avail or not avail in the classroom or the school, kind of blanket assumptions about what the situation must have been.
Well, there's a sort of primary presumption, and not entirely unwarranted, that there is in some sense an attempt to silence religious speech in the public square, and perhaps more particularly any sort of speech that might even possibly be perceived as having some sort of public or official sanction. So whether that's taking place in a public school or at a public event or a city or municipal, state, federal-sponsored event, there is an assumption, and it's not entirely unwarranted, that there's some attempt to silence those. There is also an assumption that, especially in public schools, the curricula is slanted or biased against Christian points of view or more generally religious points of view. I suppose that sometimes that leads to an assumption, which is not quite so warranted, that you know, therefore all public school teachers must in some sense be, if not hostile to, at least ambivalent about religion, which is a little bit ironic because there are, of course, lots of Christians and other religious people active in public life and in public schools, in part because they want to model their faith, if not necessarily proclaim their faith in any explicit way, in the public square.
I got a couple other questions on this.
Sure.
I mean, you approach a lot of this in terms of history. What do you think, at least in American Christianity, has changed in the last, well, we're going to have to probably put it now at 50 or 60 years, that in the public square, Christianity's place in the public square, and the public school becomes a lens for that because it's children. It magnifies these things. What has actually changed in that environment, as opposed to how Christians perceive what has changed in that environment?
Right. Yeah, good question. Well, a lot of things have changed. I mean, I'm not myself old enough to know what things were like in public schools 50 years ago, but I hear stories and I read accounts. I mean, broadly speaking, one of the things that has changed, at least in the popular mind, is a primary assumption that all religious ideas are irrational. They're not grounded in any sort of evidence, any sort of logic. And so, of course, they're not the sorts of things that should have a place in public deliberation, whether that be legal deliberation or in the teaching that goes on in a public school. So once you begin with the assumption that religion, although it might be legitimate to hold some religious beliefs, because those beliefs are irrational, they ought not to have no place in public debate, there is a bias created. There was something else I immediately wanted to follow that up with, and it's completely flipped my mind now.
Well, I mean, I asked what has actually changed, but then how do Christians now popularly, especially magnified by social media and things like that, what is their perception of what has changed?
Right. Well, I just remembered what I was going to say previously. The other thing that has changed is simply the plethora of lawsuits and legal action. And so, I mean, I sympathize in some respects with this student and with his family because and with the teacher because it's a no-win situation. I mean, we could just as have likely have been seeing opposite headlines because someone was bringing a lawsuit because a teacher actually allowed the distribution of candy canes with a Christian message on them. And so there is this just sort of fear that we have to walk on eggshells whenever one of these issues arises.
What role do you think social media plays, especially in the last 5 years, of fanning the flames of Christian the kind of sense of outrage as well?
I think it's played a huge role, not only because it allows people to vocalize their emotions or their thoughts immediately and you know without passing through the hands and under the eyes of an editor or requiring a little bit of forethought and then rumination. It allows us to say or write things that if we were forced to slow down, coherently organize our thoughts, pass them through some sort of editor, might not make it into the public square. But it's also simply made such expressions much more widely disseminated. And, you know, along with that, we hear a lot about the new media and these sorts of, especially electronic media, and comparison with the mainline media. And again, that is often perceived as liberal or having an anti-religious or specifically anti-Christian bias. And so the new media is, again, feeling, I suppose, that there's some sort of war between the proponents of those who would spread information one way versus another way.
Finally, then, what do you think all of us can learn, especially Christian consumers of media, Christians who are, in some senses, rightly concerned about the state of the public square and public schools? What can we learn from this scenario we've talked about?
Well, I suppose going back to my initial comment about understanding the suspicion and the subsequent outrage when we hear stories like this, that is perfectly understandable given our human nature. But it's also one of the reasons that we have been given something like the Ten Commandments to help curb what our human nature would otherwise do. And so especially with regard to something like the Eighth Commandment, we as Christians especially ought to take that seriously and put the best construction on all things. So especially when we read a media account where something is alleged, we should take that seriously. This is not an established fact. It is alleged by someone. There is another side to the story, and until we have all of the facts, if we ever have all of the facts, perhaps we should put the best construction on it and not immediately leap to the conclusion that this person is anti-Christian, immoral, in some way the cause of the problem.
Dr. Corey Moss is Assistant Professor of History at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. He's author of a recent column for First Things titled, A Teacher Slandered. You can read it under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Moss, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
When we come back, we'll talk about media coverage of religion. Tammy Ross of GetReligion.org will be our guest.
Thankful for God's service through the pastors in your life? Then consider attending Christ for Us in the Office of the Holy Ministry, a conference of the Association of Confessing Evangelical Lutheran Congregations, this coming February 25th through 27th in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Visit our website at acelc.net for information on Christ for Us in the Office of the Ministry. Register online at acelc.net.
Thank you for helping us make budget again last year. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for almost 6 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support. Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world, Issues, etc., and sacred music for the world, LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're looking forward to partnering with you in 2014.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If Issues, Etc. refuses to scratch your itchy ears and scratches your old scabs instead, and you love them for it, then Redeemer Lutheran Church is the church in Fort Wayne for you. The only real difference between Issues, Etc. and Redeemer is that Todd and Jeff only talk about Jesus. We talk about Jesus, but we also put him into people's mouths. We drive off demons with water. We are the church. And yes, we serve Jell-O in the basement.
The CLCC Spring Conference, Building Up the Body of Christ, is April 29th and 30th in Bloomington, Minnesota. Join us, won't you, with Pastors Jonathan Fisk, David Kind, and Rob Jarvis, and explore ideas for engaging youth and younger adults to become more involved in the life of the church. We hope you can be there with us. All the conference details are at theclcc.org. Building Up the Body of Christ, April 29th and 30th in Bloomington, Minnesota. Get registered today at theclcc.org.